Hello, and welcome to the License to Queer podcast, where we are on a mission to uncover why James Bond appeals so much to LGBTQ plus people. Why not C007 from a different angle? I recently watched a really interesting film called Jason Bend, Queen and Country, the gay James Bond film of all things. I can't believe that this film passed me by on initial release, and when I finally caught up with it nearly a decade after its initial release, I was full of questions about that film. Now, on the License to Queer website, you can read my review of Jason Bend, and although I go into it in some detail, as I say, I still had lots of questions about it. Fortunately, the director himself, a lovely guy called Matt Carter, was able to make some time for me and him to have a conversation about Jason Bend, despite him actually being knee-deep in post-production at the time on his new feature. His new feature called In From The Side is a very personal story about gay rugby players and the impact their relationship has on their club. And it's drawn very heavily from Matt's real-life experiences. A cinematic polymath, Matt does not just direct, but he also shoots his films, director of photography, scores them, and does the visual effects. And that's what he spends most of his time doing when he's not making his own films. He's passionate about telling stories which show that masculinity is not off limits for gay men. That's kind of where we start our discussion, really, but that's not where it ends. We talked about the challenges of making a James Bond film for the equivalent money of the toilet roll budget on Skyfall, as he puts it, about £2,000. That's all they had to make Jason Bend, and they made the money stretch in classic James Bond fashion. So he talks about that. We also get really deep into the music of Bond and his film Jason Bend, and he describes approaching scoring the film like John Barry. Really fascinating, that discussion. Both of us really passionate about Bond music. We also talk about telling a gay story while avoiding coming out cliches, how you go about representing the spectrum of gay identities from mask to femme and everything in between, countering of what happens in the rugby club showers mentality. It's a tough one. That stereotype that people have of gay rugby clubs. Confronting your demons by laying your life bare in your work. We really get stuck into that one. We also have a really interesting discussion about how you go about editing a sex scene for maximum impact without making it too, we also talk about other things that you might struggle to get past censors, including, well, I won't spoil it, but if you've seen Jason Bend, you probably know what I'm talking about. Fascinating bits about how to feature an Aston Martin in your movie for free, whether you'd ever consider a sequel for Jason Bend. Spoiler alert, he's come up with a really good title, should that ever happen. We also talk about his idea for a bisexual themed psychological thriller, which sounds absolutely fascinating. How to get permission to feature Grindr, the dating app, in your film, and much more. Actually, in an hour's conversation, we covered an awful lot of ground. And actually, once we stopped recording, we carried on. So it's kind of a shame that we didn't record some of those bits as well, but perhaps those may feature in an upcoming episode. On the License to Queer website, you'll find links to the official website and Instagram of Matt's forthcoming film, In From The Side, which sounds absolutely amazing. And yeah, I hope you check that out, and I hope you enjoy this interview with Matt Carter. I certainly did. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me. It's good, thank you.
I think you're really busy at the moment, aren't you? Aren't you in the process of finishing, or have you finished the film and you're seeking distribution?
So the new film I've started, I've been working on for the last about 3 years now. I'm in literally the final stages of post-production at the moment. So doing the final sort of sound mix, getting the colour grade done. But it's been a journey because this one's quite a long one. Unlike the last one, which was a bit short, this one's about just a little over 2 hours. So it's a bit more hefty. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So thank you so much for giving up some of your time, because I know it must be really, really manic. I really know. I've not had the experience of trying to get a whole feature film together and distributed. But obviously it sounds like an absolute trial. I'm right in saying Jason Bend was your first feature.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yeah. So ever since I saw your first feature, I saw it for the first time about 6 months ago, and I was kicking myself, to be perfectly honest, because I've been doing License to Queer for nearly 2 years in April, and obviously I've been a gay James Bond fan for a lot longer than that, but I didn't even know the existence of this film, and I think I just happened upon it by accident, to be perfectly honest. And ever since I've seen it, I haven't been able to get certain images and settings and characters and things out of my head, so I'm really excited to talk to you about that. But obviously, I also want to talk to you about your new film, because one of the things I noticed, and so your new film is described, I've took this from the film's website, the synopsis of your film is: following a drunken encounter, two equally attached men from a cash-strapped and divided gay rugby club unwittingly sleepwalk into an adulterous affair, but must conceal their growing feelings or risks destroying the club they love. I presume that's still an accurate synopsis now you've finished the film.
That's still an accurate synopsis. That's the script, that's the story, that's the film, yeah.
So gay James Bond, gay rugby, two really hyper-masculine, typically straight male-dominated context spaces. I don't know if you've psychoanalyzed yourself much here, Matt, but why do you think you're drawn to telling stories in those contexts?
I mean, I could talk for hours about this. I have very much psychoanalyzed myself and this content material about sort of, you know, this subject matter. I think it's I'm fascinated by the idea that masculinity is off limits for gay men, or that somehow that they're at odds with each other, and that, you know, the concept of masculinity is a predominantly straight phenomenon. I find that fascinating. That's a presumption that people start from, because I think, where to start with this? It's such a deep thing. I mean, it's interesting because I don't think I'd really considered this as much doing Jason Bend as I had doing, obviously, the rugby film, because obviously it's a bit more at the forefront when you're talking about rugby. Because I've been involved in sort of playing sort of gay and inclusive rugby now for about 7 years. It's something that I'm confronted with a lot, and that really pushed it to the forefront of my mind when making the film, because it was something I was quite interested in. But you're right, I think James Bond is a very stereotypically kind of masculine, kind of, I guess, heterosexual, because of James Bond being a heterosexual character, domain. But I think, again, I don't believe that should be something that is exclusive to straight people or to the heterosexual, heteronormative world, I think is the term that's often used, banded around. And I find flipping that on its head just sort of shows that actually, you know, when making, I mean, just to give a bit of context, you know, Jason Bend was basically my film score. I was 22 when I made it. It was made on about $2,000, nothing. And I just kind of, it was a little fun project that was meant to be like a 5 or 10 minute thing that just kept growing and growing. And then we sort of ended up being about 50 minute, which was a kind of a TV hour. We thought it would be quite fun if it's like a pilot for a TV show. And obviously just it became a standalone thing. But it was just the concept of like, what would it be like if gay, you know, James Bond was a gay man instead of a straight man? And we sort of sat down and thought about it and thought, actually, probably not very different. And that in itself was quite interesting, just to kind of explore it almost as if it's kind of a Roger Moore era film.
Yeah.
All the innuendos are the same. Roger Moore films are so camp anyway. You're really a skirting line in terms of like, it's almost quite gay in itself. So you don't really have to change too much, apart from just it's Bond boys instead of Bond girls, and the innuendos are slightly more phallic related. But really, that's kind of where the sort of similarity, you know, ended. It was very interesting to explore that, and literally just to play it as if it were a Roger Moore sort of style Bond, rather than sort of a bit more of the modern ones where it's taken more seriously. But at the same time, you know, the jokes are so ridiculous that you kind of have to do it deadpan. Otherwise, it just comes across as like Austin Powers, essentially. Didn't write the script. Yeah.
So it must be really difficult not to kind of cross that line.
Kind of. I mean, so Andrew wrote the script. He was the producer on the film. Mm. And for the rugby film, I've written the script on this one. But actually, interesting, I got sort of involved with him as a producer. Later down the line, we sort of reconnected. And I said, you know, actually, produce the next movie. And he was like, all right. But it's a very different production because it was, you know, very different style of movie as well. But, you know, he wrote the script and I directed it. So it had, the script was, it could have been directed in a kind of Austin Powers way. But I thought it'd be really interesting to direct a script, which may not have been written more for an Austin Powers style, in a kind of more straight deadpan kind of Roger Moore style Bond. And I thought whenever we screened it, at festivals and stuff, it's quite interesting that people kind of, the lines are said with a straight face and that sort of dissonance creates a bit of comedy that the audience always chuckle and, you know, it worked quite well. I mean, it's funny you could come to Jason Bourne quite so late because obviously he came out in about 2014. Yeah. And for me, I sort of, because I've come so far and such a long way since then in terms of trying to hone my craft of filmmaking, I sort of look back on it and kind of put my head in my hands and go, God, did I really make that? Because it was just a bit of fun, you know. And then it got into all these festivals and became way bigger than we ever really intended it to be, really. And it's funny how it just got redistributed again by a French company last year during lockdown. Oh, wow. I think because they're sort of struggling for material. So I don't know what the French title of it was. But it's funny how it's sort of just, it's taken a life of its own and just kept going, really. And it's sort of, because it is a, you know, a shoestring budget film. You know, you've got to be honest about it. It's not like highbrow. It's not very well constructed. But it's, from what I would consider to be, you know, the stuff I make now, for instance. But it was really fun to make. Like, we had an absolute blast. And even though it is kind of so bad, it's good, a bit like The Room, kind of, you know, Tommy Wiseau sort of style, like it's not in some parts. it was really fun. It's nice that it has kind of found its audience, you know, even if it's a bit later, people sort of, you know, still keep coming back to it and sort of, you know, talking about it as you have, you know. It's refreshing. It was nice to sort of read the article that you wrote on New Year's Day going, oh, someone's rediscovered Jason Bourne. That was all fun.
I'm just bracing you. There are quite a few people who do podcasts who I appear on occasionally who have said, we should record a podcast about Jason Bourne. So it might not be the last rediscovery. I'm just warning you in advance. Okay.
Well, that's nice. That's nice. That's nice to hear.
I mean, a part of me doesn't. Oh, I feel guilty in a sense for kind of dragging you back through your past work, because if I think about the sort of stuff that I created, you know, I tend to write more than anything else. But I think about the stuff I created back when I was 22, I'd be like mortified if someone wanted to tease that apart. But I for my money anyway, I think that I don't know. I honestly don't know how you did that film, even on, you know, $2,000, because, you know, a lot of independent films, they go down like a horror route, don't they, or a social realist route, because you can sort of hide the lack of production value that way. But you can't do that with a Bond story, or can you? Well, clearly you did.
I love that you feel we hid the production, like, sort of our budget, because whenever I watch it, well, I see it like the ropey sets and like sort of the, you know, the dodgy color grading and stuff that, you know, but it was an experience. I mean, I was very lucky. I had a lot of resources and friends and stuff who had access. We had a studio that one of my friends owned that let us shoot pretty much all the interior locations there. I mean, we built no sets. We just, you know, they're all kind of rooms, really. And I just went, it's all shot in London. And obviously they have, you know, the film's set in sort of Geneva and in foreign locations. And I literally just, because my parents live in France, I just went to Geneva for the day, just crossed the border and just shot loads of B-roll and just cut between it and say, oh, it was the one location. She's like, no, it's not. They're just literally inserts of shots and try and make it feel like it's in a foreign location. But
which actually is what they do in Bond films. You know, there's no, Daniel Craig has not been for he didn't go to Shanghai to shoot Skyfall. It's like so obviously second unit.
They might have done. I think there's some bits they definitely, I mean, especially at the late, you know, the most recent Bonds, they definitely go on location shoot stuff. But we always had the joke when making Jason Bourne that we had the sort of the Skyfall toilet paper budget, you know, and it probably was, you know, they had more money to spend on things like that than we had to spend on an entire movie. But I think a lot of it is, you know, we trying to be clever with the camera work. And I do visual effects for a living. So, you know, just literally throwing in the sort of the space sequences and stuff is like something that actually isn't too difficult for me to do, but for someone else would be quite expensive.
I was going to say,
sort of, you know,
Yeah, the visual effects and the music, I think, help an awful lot. And I know that you're obviously responsible for those as well. So not just the special effects, but also the music. And music is one of the parts of Bond which I absolutely adore, and I'm I'll listen to my Spotify most played list at the end of any year is usually music from Bond, even though I own them on CD and vinyl and everything else as well. So I'm going to hazard a guess here and say you're based on the music you wrote for Jason Bend, either you just are really good at kind of listening to other people's music and synthesizing kind of what makes it tick, or you're a massive Bond music fan. So which of the two is it?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, you know, what I love kind of about your article is actually that you focused on the score, because the score was actually quite a lot of the work that went into doing the movie. Like, it took kind of a good sort of over the space, you know, because I was doing it while working, about 6 months of work just to sort of throw together, you know, working in the evenings to do the music for it. Because it's about 35 to 40 minutes of music. So it was quite a lot of work. And I think that the Bond music is really kind of what gives the character and the soul of Bond in some sense.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to be, I didn't want to use the Bond theme, but I wanted something that was reminiscent of it. And I love the sort of the general, you know, the reoccurrence of what we call leitmotif in music is, you know, a theme that's associated with a musical motif that's associated with either a character or a theme. And that reoccurring throughout the film as a storytelling device. So obviously it's used very heavily in Bond. You know, John Barry used it a lot. You know, the actual Bond theme when it reappears, or classically the theme song of the film reappearing sort of contextualized through an orchestra as as you go through the film as sort of a leitmotif. And I really wanted to have that because I felt that was such an essential Bond thing. So the very first thing we did was just I wrote the theme song, Queen of Country, and then just reorchestrated that continuously throughout it. But a lot of the references were listening to really classic kind of John Barry stuff, some Arnold stuff, and listening to a bit of like the Thomas Newman stuff. I'm a massive Thomas Newman fan, and it was so interesting that he was chosen to do Skyfall, because it was kind of, it's an unusual choice because his style of music I didn't think would marry up with Bond very well. And so in some ways I kind of steered away from being too Newman-esque in doing stuff because he has a very distinct sound. Obviously in the new film, I love Thomas Newman, and I think there are certain parts that are very Newman-esque, but that's because it's more, you know, it works better for the Rugby movie because it's a much more sort of drama, not comedy kind of thing, Bond. But it's interesting because I took a lot of time to listen to stuff and really kind of think about what would work for the scenes, but also, you know, picking up cues from other films and going, okay, what makes that work? And, you know, I sort of have a musical background and, you know, I play piano and guitar and I produce all the music, and I've scored the new film, which was even more work because that was, you know, about an hour and 15 minutes of music. Very different style, completely different to the Bond, you know, the stuff we did for Jason Bend, but much more sort of ambient, really kind of exploring some different styles with that. But it was a lot of work for both movies, just the score. And I do, I listened to a lot of the classic stuff and went and kind of based it on that, really.
So who out of you and Andrew, the writer, was the bigger Bond fan?
It's funny because I particularly was a massive Bond fan more than anyone else, but through the process of making Jason Bend, I went back and watched a lot of them and sort of made myself into a bit of a Bond fan. And then after making Jason Bend, watching all the new films as they came out, because we finished the film just before Skyfall sort of came out. So, you know, I went to watch Skyfall just as we were kind of finishing the last bits of it. And when they had the scene I think it's with Javier by then, when they sort of, that's a slight gay flirtatious moment, I was like, damn, they beat us to it. Because we just finished, I was like, oh, they beat us to the anyway. But I think Andrew, again, I think he just went back and watched loads of them. And it's funny because, you know, the script, I mean, I think if anything, if I could change anything about Jason Bend, I wish we spent a bit more time refining the script a bit more. Because I think we literally just lifted a lot of it from the existing Bond films, like, and kind of made a template and just made the film. I think we could have maybe explored some of the character a bit more, but we were just, we didn't know it was going to be the thing it was at the start. It was just a short film that kept growing and growing. And so we didn't really think, you know, we weren't paying the same sort of level of detail and attention that we were doing, you know, if it were a feature script, like we've done with the Rugby movie, where I spent about, you know, a year and a half to 2 years, really get that script super tight. We literally threw the Jason Bend script together about in a couple of weeks. We're just adding and taking away scenes almost as we were coming up to shooting. It was not, the whole project was just a fun thing that was just a bit of fun that, you know, for us doing the evenings while we're working. It was never meant to be like a really big, like, to project be taken seriously. And I kind of wish we'd known what it would become before we'd started, so that we could have, again, given it that bit of extra attention. But, you know, it's fine. It is what it is, you know. And like you said, it's kind of dragging up old things that we've done 10, 12 years ago. because it's crazy to think, you know, we sort of, about 2012 was when we finished it. So it's literally 10 years ago now since Jason Men's finished. And it's like, it's crazy to think how time flies, really.
I think as as a gay man as well, that I think it's so empowering to have a gay James Bond who isn't a stereotypical sissy character. And I'm not going to like camp or femme shame or anything along those lines, of course. But at the same time, it could have been so easy to get. I think if you say gay James Bond to most people, that's probably what they would imagine it being like. And it's really interesting to have this really, you know, apart, as you said earlier, apart from just being into men and women, it's actually not that different. So was that something you were adamant about from the start? We're not going to go down that route.
Well, yes. I mean, there's one, my sort of generalization kind of like my ideological principles of filmmaking for gay cinema is I am really bored of homophobia storylines and coming out storylines. I think it's done to death. I mean, not to say there's not a place for it, but there's plenty of people making those films. Whereas I don't think there's a place of people, I don't think there's as much material being made that just explore authentic gay men just living their life and living other stories. And I think you kind of have to model the world you want to see as well as reflecting the world that you're in. And I think I really wanted there to be no, Jason Bend was not to have any issues with his own sexuality. The world around him wouldn't have any issues with his sexuality. He's just a character, comfortable with who he is, as James Bond is. You know, James Bond has no issues with his own sexuality, so why should Jason Bend? And he's just going through the world doing a job, you know, being a spy. And I think in terms of sort of the, you know, the whether he should have been sort of masculine or sort of femme, again, James Bond isn't femme, that is. You know, he's a sort of stereotypically masculine character. So Jason Bend had to be the same, because what would James Bond be like if he were gay? And I don't think just making someone gay means you change their personality. It's just who they find attractive. It's simple as that. And again, then we have the wide spectrum of people who fall on the sort of masculinity, femininity spectrum in the film as, you know, the secondary characters. So we were definitely covering all those bases, but I thought it was important that we didn't. It would say the wrong message to make Jason Bend a very camp, effeminate character, because that would say, we think making a spy gay means they have to be this. And, absolutely, you know, and there is a spectrum of the way people behave in real life. And I think now sort of this theme is something that I think of very much with the rugby film. I do think there's a kind of a tendency in the gay community to, and this is a controversial topic, but to sort of almost mask shame in some sense, because I think maybe it's a backlash to the fact that, obviously being masculine has been thought of as the default for so long that there's, you know, it's like a pendulum. It swings the other way, that now it's kind of, everyone's very sort of femme proud, which is fine. But in the sense, I think that sort of has now said that if you're a masculine or let's say straight presenting gay man, that you're somehow inauthentic, or you're internalizing your own homophobia, and that the default gay man is a RuPaul loving kind of sassy kind of, that's the norm. And I think a lot of the questions I get about Jason Bend make me think that is what's happening, because people think it's strange that I must be sort of femme erasing to not have him be that way. And I'm like, well, it shouldn't you think that way, because it's like you're saying that that's the default, when actually people can be anything, and there's different ways to be authentic. Spectrum. It's not always one thing. Exactly. And I sort of feel that, especially when, I mean, as someone who plays rugby, a lot of people think, you know, like the questions I get asked on a regular basis, you know, as your gay man plays rugby, what happens in the showers? You know, is it not a bit scary? You know, it's a little bit rough. And you think, it's such strange questions you get, and it says so much about people's assumptions more than it actually does about the world we live in. And I think, you know, for Jason Bend, that's why he's exactly like James Bond, but gay. And why would that be any different to what James Bond is, you know, in terms of the way he presents in terms of masculinity or his sort of femininity? So, yeah, I hope that answers the question in a very long-winded way.
It totally does, and fascinating me, to be honest. So if we kind of move to your new film, I took another quote from the Kickstarter page, That I don't. Is the Kickstarter still going? I know that you reached your target of £10,000, but is the Kickstarter still going if people do want to donate to help with distribution and things?
Unfortunately, this is the format of Kickstarters. You have like a 30-day window to donate, and then after
that's actually it. Cut off?
But, it cuts off. Yeah, you have to reach your target by the end of the day, at the end of the deadline. Otherwise, you don't get anything. So it's kind of an all or nothing platform. So unfortunately, you know, if people donate, it's too late. And we've also made the film. So I mean, welcome to send your money, but it'll be lining my pockets rather than being used for anything. But obviously, the Kickstarter's still going in the sense that we've yet to finish the film completely. So there's people waiting for to see their copy of it.
Right.
Very patiently after three years. Yeah. I think I very much underestimated the time it would take to finish a movie this length single-handedly, because I think I very much thought it'd be the same as Jason Bend, but it's there's a lot more work.
I can imagine. And on that page, you say it's a new kind. You didn't want it to be depressing, and quote, "It's a new kind of gay cinema beyond sexuality angst," which is pretty much what you've just said, isn't it? You don't want to do another coming out story. And I love coming out stories, but you're right. It's kind of like there's room for those, but we need people living authentic, relatively happy lives. So without giving too much away about the new film, is that what we're going to see when it's eventually released?
To an extent, I don't know about living happy lives. Because I don't think just being out is the once you're out, your life's plain sailing. And I think also if you have characters that are always happy, that you've got zero conflict, and it's nothing no kills drama, than characters are exactly. But no, I think I enjoy coming out of films like anyone. You know, I think it, but because I relate to it. I think it's very, and this is not to denigrate it at all, but I think it's quite easy writing, because you know coming out is such an obvious source of drama and stress. That it's kind of, if you want to write gay characters, it's like, well, coming out it's what could be more dramatic than that? You know, it would be the easy thing to sort of think about.
It's got such an obvious narrative arc, hasn't it? It's like rising drama, then falling. Yeah.
And then sort of, you got the arc for most of those characters is basically they've got to learn to be themselves, or they've got to, accept who they are. It's very obvious. It almost writes itself. And I think in some sense, that's why people don't go much further beyond that, because it's so easy and it's so compelling. They end up telling the same story over and over. And again, because we all relate to it, because we've all, as gay men or people in the LGBT community, all relate to that story. But I think if you really want to push past that and be more relatable, I'm more interested in stories that everyone can relate to. So, I mean, all the characters in From the Side, which is the name of the new film, they're all out. There's no homophobia storylines, but it's all about the different struggles that everyone kind of faces, not just, but the story's uniquely gay because it's set in an environment, a rugby club full of gay men, and sort of the uniqueness that environment provides in terms of storytelling. But essentially it's a story about sort of monogamy, infidelity, falling in love with people who you can't have. It's a forbidden love story, but the forbiddenness doesn't come from a homophobic world or from coming out. And that was kind of the hook that made me super interested about it, was to sort of tell a story that, you know, because most gay love stories, are forbidden love stories, but it's forbidden because they can't have the person they want because they're already available. And how, the slippery slopes that people that we get into, if you sleep with someone on a one night stand and then you spend lots of time with them. And, like I said, this sleepwalk into an adulterous affair where you kind of have to hide it. And how do you hide a secret in an environment like a rugby club where it's almost impossible to keep secrets from anyone? And that was the kind of the premise of the movie. And also where, everyone's friends with everyone, and the drama that can cause, the secondary sort of drama and the ripples in the water that a single event can cause, and how many other people's lives it can ruin.
So feel free to tell me to jog on or just say no comment to this. But on the website, I think it was the Kickstarter site again, you did say, "I myself had once been involved in a similar romantic situation with a fellow club member, and that experience and what transpired heavily informed and inspired the writing process." So I don't expect you to lay your life bare, although I do that regularly. I'm just queer, it's warts and all.
Well, but I'll make this very easy for you. I mean, I have laid my life bare. It's the movie. I mean, it's not complete. It's heavily fictionalized, but You know, the story is very much based on some of my experiences in a similar relationship situation, but also my experiences of what the inclusive rugby world is like. But you know, I've definitely bore my soul in this film a lot. You know, at this point I can't hide it because everyone's going to watch the movie. You know, but it's too late now. Well, exactly. Quite. You know, it's a very personal story. You know, there's a lot of things that I've had to process. You know, things that, from my behaviour in the past that I've explored through the medium of storytelling in film to kind of to almost self-reflect on. I mean, it, like I said, it's a very fictionalized story. You know, if anyone watches the movie, thinks that exactly will happen. It, you know, it's ridiculously dramatic. Like nothing like that could happen. Who knows, in real life. But no, it's definitely there was a relationship I was involved with that was very similar to the setup in the movie. And I remember thinking, God, that actually it was quite dramatic for me, and it was quite sort of traumatic as well. You know, and I thought that's quite a good starting off point to then tell a story from. And then you know that was the core print, the sort of premise. And then from that we sort of built all these secondary fictional characters and these situations to put that situation in, and that was where the drama was born from. So you know, there's a lot of me in the movie, and you know, the characters. I think I relate to all. There's parts of me in all the characters. I think we've all got, you know, there's lots of archetypes of, you know, people we know. I think it's about fraternity, really. It's a group of gay men who, you know, in this sporting environment, we spend a lot of time. It's very few places, I think, apart from high school. You know, or sort of college or whatever, but for adults, where you're forced to spend a lot of time with people who you're often very different with, you know, and you spend a lot of time with people and you don't always get on. It's like a sort of family almost. And to do that as adults, apart from the workplace maybe, it's very unusual. And rugby clubs are quite unique in that sense. So there's, you know, people don't always get along. You know, you do get these friendships form, and people sort of, you know, have to put up with people they don't like, and that creates a lot of drama. And I think there's lots of elements of, I think, I feel like my experience in it, all the characters, you know, I've been the person who has fancied their best friend and can't, you know, won't get with them because they don't fancy you back, or the person who, you know, feels like the outsider, or the person who's, you know, we've all had these experiences.
Yeah,
I think
definitely. So yeah, all of the above.
It is a very
yeah
well, exactly. And I think everyone relates to a lot of the characters, and I think, you know, there is a lot of me in it, so yeah, I can't pretend that it's not, you know, because it's the truth. I'd rather say it's the truth. I think I've tried to be as truthful as possible telling that story, you know, drawing from my own experience as much as possible, really.
So how was it revisiting? Yeah, totally. And thank you for your honesty as well. But how was it revisiting some of those experiences? Because I'm writing something for the website, or I'm doing a podcast or something, and I'm like, do I really want to go there? And sometimes I almost hold myself back, but in the end, I'm grateful that I don't, because it kind of, even though I sometimes put myself through the mill writing about things that have happened, I end up feeling, it's quite cathartic, to be honest. I end up feeling better by the end. So how did you feel approaching it?
I think, yeah, catharsis is a really, really good word for it. Mm. It is, it's you're confronting your demons, and in a kind of, and I think I'm quite a forthright person. I don't sort of hold, you know, I'm happy to sort of bare my soul in a sense. I think if you're an artist of any kind, you kind of have to do that, especially if you want to produce really, you know, good work. You have to kind of bare a bit of your soul. You can't, I don't know, maybe some people do, but I personally think that, you know, the more of myself I put in my work, the more interesting I find the work becomes. Yeah. But it was, I mean, a lot of the, you know, I'm exploring these events sort of many, many years after they occurred. So I've had a lot of time to retrospectively think about these things. So there's a certain distance from it. You know, I feel like I'm a very different person making this film now to the person who experienced some of those similar experiences when I was younger. So it's like looking back on almost a different life in a sense. But there are certain parts where it's interesting where you see a scene performed that's very reminiscent of a scene that you've lived, and then you think there's some almost other outer bodily experience you have when you're doing that. You think it's like you stepping out of yourself and seeing something reinterpreted by actors, you know, through a script. That you can always tell when there's a moment of truth being born through, because you get a feeling. Andrew would always say, you know, he'd see me smiling behind the camera, and he always know that there was something magical happening when I was doing that, because I'd always have such a focused face normally. But sometimes there's a moment where everything's coming together, and it's producing something really, like a really interesting moment that you can't help but sort of grin and sort of feel something, and you're even just watching it being performed on set. So it was an interesting experience. Yeah, I'm looking forward to showing it to the world, you know, when it's finally done. After that, I mean, the actors are chomping at the bit for me to finish this movie, and I'm working in it as fast as I can. But at the same time, I want it to be right. You know, I think I wanted, having done films like Jason Bend, you know, where we didn't get everything right, I wanted to try and get this as right as possible within what we can afford budget wise. Because this was also quite a low budget film. You know, I mean, we think we made a, spent about, it's hard to say, around about 60 grand, I think, on this. But for a feature, you know, that's nothing. But I mean, a lot of that is because I own a lot of the camera equipment. I'm obviously doing most of the post-production myself, but all of it really. You know, and I'm able to bring a lot of value to the production by, like, you know, scoring it myself and doing that sort of stuff, which would normally cost probably the budget of the movie if you're paying a composer to do that. So, you know, we're able to economize. But yeah, it's a very low budget film, and therefore I kind of want to massage it and make it as good as I can before putting it out there. So that's probably why it's taken as long as it has, really.
In between the two films, what have you spent? I see your IMDb credits. You've done more directing of quite a bit of TV. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, I do a lot of... visual effects is my sort of bread and butter. So I do a lot of effects work, and that's kind of what's paid for my creative life, essentially, in all the films and other stuff I do. And so in that time, I think when Jason Bend was finishing, I've just been working a lot. I've just been doing a lot of TV stuff. I bought myself from quite a good sort of cinema camera, and I've been shooting a lot, just really refining my craft, getting my cinematography down, because I'm a photographer at heart. I've been doing that since I was a teenager, just moving that into cinematography and really trying to get that visual style nailed down was kind of the all. I spent years prepping to make this, you know, the Rugby movie. Really, I knew, you know, when I was writing the script that where it was going to go, and it wouldn't be done for 5 years or so. You know, this is back when I was starting to writing it in sort of 2017. So there was a lot of prep work going into that, and I spent a lot of time just sort of, you know, improving myself as a creator. And I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, totally. So the new film is called In From the Side. I'm not massively into sport generally. Sorry to be a gay stereotype, but I'm not massively into sport. But I presume In From the Side is both a rugby manoeuvre, if that's the right word, I feel really, but also is perhaps has a double meaning. Is that correct?
That's exactly it. Yeah. So it's a rugby term. It's an illegal move that you can make in rugby, or like that you can fringe doing. But it's also, you know, I like the idea of sort of coming in from the side of a relationship. So you've got sort of a stable relationship and someone coming in from the side door that kind of throws that and can offset it. But it's also a slightly cryptic phrase that I think generates a bit of intrigue, because it's not clear what it means. It's that kind of, I mean, it's that sort of call me by your name style, you know, it's just a strange phrase in and of itself that draws intrigue. And that was kind of, I felt like there were several kind of titles that, you know, banded around, but a lot of them felt a bit on the nose. And I thought that was just, I found it, there's a mysteriousness to it that I thought was quite interesting, which is kind of fits the story quite well.
What do you think, now you've mentioned Call Me By Your Name, you've started me thinking, so what kind of gay cinema of the last few years would you rate more highly than the others? Any particular favourites?
I'm terrible at recalling movies, full stop. Like, someone says, what's your favourite movie? I just turn a blank. So this is a very difficult question anyway.
What about also, Call Me By Your Name? What did you make of that one?
It was.
I was a bit disappointed.
Yeah. No, that's not disappointed. Wasn't an exhale of disappointment. That was how do I answer this question? So the first few times I watched it, it's basically the one of the other producers in the film, in From the Side, was raving about it way before I got the chance to see it. So the expectation was set super high. The first time I went to see it, we got a third through the movie, and the projection broke.
Oh no!
And then they ended the film there. So and then it broke a second time when I went back to watch it again at the same venue, and they were really sorry. So I saw the first half twice before getting the chance to watch it from start to finish in one go. So it was the, you know, I feel awful for the director that, you know, I watched it in the worst way possible, you know, where you see the first half, you know, and I didn't see it in one complete sitting as a film should be watched. So I already went, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to like this, because it's a slower movie. I mean, it's not a fast paced film, and I think it does need to be consumed in one go. So I, unfortunately, that was ruined for me in some sense. But having watched it a few times and reflected on it years past, I think it's a lovely movie. I do think it's a little indulgent. I think I think one of the criticisms that we might get is that I think ours is actually a little mainstream, because it's not typically like a typical independent film that has that kind of look, you know, the kind of where you can hear the boom operator hitting the actor on the head. You know, it's that kind of where there's almost no music and you just hear and see, and the shots almost outstay their welcome. And I feel like Call Me By Your Name did that quite a bit. and it has, you know, has that classical music score. It's very of a genre. Yeah. Now, I having watched it a few more times, you know, I think the performances are completely captivating and absorbing. And it's very much of its time. The locations are beautiful, and you do kind of get swept up in the feel of it. But I do feel and this is a bit Philistine thing, and I know people are going to hate me for this, but I feel when you deprive an audience of new information by making it feel quite slow, the audience will start to fill in the gaps themselves, and they start to create meaning that might not be there.
Absolutely.
And I think you know that could be intentional, perhaps. But I'd much prefer to. I like to entertain people. I want people to actually watch a movie and feel like they're being entertained. And if I'm boring them, then I feel like, you know, or then I'm maybe being a bit too indulgent. Now people probably watch my movie and think, you know, the new one, and think, well, it was indulgent. I'm sure they'll say that, but you know, but I've made an attempt to for the story to continually go and go and go, and for it to never sort of get flat. And if there are moments where it slows down, it's for a reason, rather than it just being, you know, the whole movie has to go at this slower pace. And I don't want to alienate, you know, audience members who are expecting entertainment. And I feel like Called by Your Name is a film really for people who enjoy that festival style of film, and it will potentially alienate people who aren't gay or who are going and expecting something a bit more fast-paced. But again, that's not a criticism, that's just my view. But I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I make a point of never saying anything negative on License to Queer about any film. But the reason I asked was because you're right, there's kind of two types. It's like you've got the kind of classical kind of cause and effect, where you are being given new information all the time with strategic slowdown, and then there are some which you think, oh gosh, yes, they could have really trimmed this down. And I think the appeal of Bond to a lot of people is that it's very cause and effecty, but more recently people have kind of criticized it for kind of taking a bit more of an art house sort of style in places, at least. So no, I was just kind of for the record, I like to think I've got a really good attention span. I can watch 4-hour silent German movies and, you know, lap them up. But at the same time, even though I was like, Call Me By Your Name, I'm like, yeah, come on. They could have trimmed about half an hour out of this, and it wouldn't be any less of the film. Something else that was sort of missing from Call Me By Your Name, I know the screenwriter James Ivory has criticized the production for this, is any kind of real sex scenes in there, really? One thing I noted about Jason Bend, which I think is a great virtue of the film, because I think we kind of need more of these, although you're probably going to tell me it was purely accidental, is that actually doesn't have kind of the explicit sex that is often used to sell gay films. I noticed that the DVD copy, which I own, of Jason Bend is rated an 18, but that was because it was packaged perhaps strategically with two short films which are more sexually explicit. Was it your intention to
more strategic? It's this is a wide topic, but actually it's a shame that one of the other producers, Adam, who I met Adam when he picked up Jason Bend. And then we sort of became quite good mates, and then he found the fact that I made Jason Bend on No Money quite intriguing. When I sort of said to him about the rugby film, he was like, I would like to be involved with this, let's make this movie. And I think because he knew I was a person who can make a film on no money and make it quite good, hopefully quite good, we'll see. I mean, so that's up to you to decide. But so he wanted to be on board with that, and he'd never made a film before, but he'd obviously knew the distribution world. So I very much wanted to make Jason Bend a film that my mother could see without blushing, that sort of type thing. And I wanted to very much be Bond. And I think in a lot of the earlier Bonds, the sex is very kind of overly romanticized, a bit camp, and not very, very explicit. I think it's only some of the more recent films where that they've adopted that more gritty style that they actually start to show more explicit sex. Now, that was a whole conversation about the rugby film as well, about what level of sex we had. And in fact, of all the scenes that caused the most amount of back and forth was actually the sex scene that happens in the very middle of the movie, when we finally sort of see the characters having, you know, full-on penetrative sex kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I re-edited that scene so many times, different styles, until finally we got it working. It's beautiful now. But in the early stages, we tried to make something much more gritty. And I thought, God, this is almost pornographic. We can't do this. And then I took it back and I went, now it just has no energy. And then it literally took me to, I wrote a piece of music on the piano when I was just sort of hitting my head against the wall. And I wrote a piece of music and put that underneath it, took away all the audio of, you know, the grunting and all that sort of stuff. And then when you put beautiful music underneath something, you can almost go incredibly explicit. And I made the edit far more explicit than it had ever been before. But underneath beautiful music, it was just captivating. But and Adam would always say, that's the problem with Jason Benn. He said, it's a PG. When it was rated, it was actually, the BBC rated it as a PG. And we thought, wow, well, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. But in some ways, I was quite proud that essentially we made it a film that is family friendly. But he said, no one will buy a PG film who are gay because they'll expect it to have sex in it. So they deliberately packaged it with two explicit films to give the DVD an 18 certificate. So that was entirely strategic. And I agreed to it. And I've actually not... This is terrible. I've actually not seen those two films. I'm sorry to the filmmakers who've been bundled with one. I haven't actually watched it.
They're all right. Well, one's better than the other. Yeah, they're all right.
But I should sit down and watch it, really, because I feel that's pretty bad of me that I haven't. But I just kind of didn't want to know. And, you know, I knew what my film was, and I thought it's obviously been put for a reason. I trusted Adam on that. I think also I didn't, if I didn't enjoy the film, I didn't want to have that sinking feeling that it didn't fit well with mine. So I just haven't watched those two films.
They bear no relation to Jason Bend whatsoever, by the way. Well, that's narratively, that's really, stylistically, or anything.
Yeah. So in some ways, that makes me glad, because at least that way it's clearly, you know, DVD extras that aren't related to the film bundled on. And I think one of my parents' friends watched it and they said, the other two movies are very interesting. Oh God. But I think, you know, at least they know it's so different to mine. I definitely didn't have a hand in it. Again, no disrespect to the filmmakers. I'm sure they're great films. It's just, you know, obviously it's you know, when someone puts someone else's work with yours, you do want it to be known that, you know, it's differentiated.
Made a mistake in my article, because I thought that it was 12A, which I thought was even a bit kind of pushing it for 12A. I can't recall an exploding dildo in a PG point.
It may well be a 12A. I actually can't remember what the rating was. It was something like that. It was a very kind of family friendly rating.
Yeah.
I think an exploding dildo in itself, like it's not violent. it's not really sexual, because you're not depicting this.
No, it isn't.
There's a swearing, and those are the sort of big three. And there's no dwelling on. I'm trying to remember how the BBC rate things now. I think there's no dwelling on suffering, because the explosion cut away. So, and all the every time explosion happens, it's kind of, you know, you don't really see. I mean, at the end there is a bit of one where the villain gets blasted with a rocket, a missile, and there's blood that's hit the lens, which I thought I thought was a bit camp and fun, but that probably actually might have, like, that's the only time you really see a bit of gore. Mm. Apparently the opening scene, I think there's
a bit of blood in the opening. Yeah,
but, and I never really thought about that being particularly violent until I literally read your article on New Year's Day, and I thought, oh yeah, I suppose that is actually. Because I mean, that first scene is the first ever time I really had attempted filmmaking. Like, that was literally, I'm just winging it on that shoot. I had no idea what I was doing. I had a whole crew around me who were looking at me for leadership, I don't know what I'm doing. So I got to shoot. I hadn't really sort of thought about, the level of violence in it, but I think it was just a fun film that it didn't, the violence it needs to creep in. I think, you know, exploding dildos is in theory that's sexual, but it's not it's just an object. And I think a kid watching that wouldn't necessarily know what that was.
No,
you know,
exactly.
It's one of the things that the adults in the room would, but yeah.
And people see, you know, you see dildos in shop windows in certain parts of most cities, and Shakespeare mentions dildos. I've had to teach kids, I teach high school, and I've had to teach kids what dildos are because it comes up in Shakespeare. So, you know, it's nothing, you know, nothing we should be embarrassed about or anything.
It's also not particularly a phallic shaped dildo either. It's I think it was called the lady finger. I remember because Jen, one of the other co-creators, she brought it in and said she bought it, and it's just like a metal object. It's not even that like phallic shaped. It's apart from the fact that it's just, you know, it's a long object, but it's. It wasn't like, you know, it didn't have contours and veins or anything, so it wasn't really that explicit.
I don't know. I can't follow that up, really. So I suppose the only other question about, just to go back to Jason Benn for a second, you did have some very Bond-style product placement in there. I don't think it was intentional, or it was, but you had Grindr in there, and I wondered what the was that a licensing nightmare, or did you just kind of hope they didn't ask any questions, or was it actually something you arranged with them?
We put it in the movie, and then I thought after we'd done it, I thought we should probably get the permission, really, and they just gave it. They just said sure. They asked for a cut of the movie. I don't even know if they even actually watched it. I think it's more they just wanted to know would we provide them with a cut of the movie. But I think, you know, I can't imagine as many places that Grindr wouldn't want their, you know, would be prudish about not having it in. And it's such an innocent little gag in the movie. It's not But yeah, they gave us permission. They said fine. We asked permission and after the fact, and they said fine. Aston Martin. I think I can't remember. You know, this is like 10 years now. I can't remember all the licensing stuff. I think we tried to not show the Aston Martin logo too much because like, we knew that they would probably be a bit funny about, because they have obviously super strong ties with real James Bond.
Yes.
And we didn't want them to turn around and say no. So we just made sure that you never really see the logo very closely. Obviously, it's driving an Aston Martin. It's an the location for sort of for you know the Q's kind of workshop area where they get given his gadgets was actually an Aston Martin repair place, which was opposite the studio that we were filming at, and they just let us shoot there. And it was like another free location, like 10 meters from where we were shooting. It was perfect. It was like it was meant to be.
Amazing.
So we've got all these different Aston Martins, like, you know, different elevations being sort of widged up and stuff in the background. It was brilliant. But no, I can't remember if we have permissions for that. I hope that wasn't the thing. 10-year-old movie. It's too late now. Oh well.
It's too late now.
And obviously the villain's sort of, you know, hair brand is completely fictional. So we plastered that everywhere to sort of give him that kind of Jeff Bezos kind of feel where, you know, it's so ubiquitous. It's the whole world, you know, has it everywhere for everything. So, yeah.
I suppose the last thing to kind of talk about is upcoming projects. And I almost don't want to ask you because you must be just kind of so consumed by In From the Side that you're not kind of thinking ahead. But I must say that since I posted my article a few days ago on License to Quit, quite a few people have started coming up with kind of all ideas for sequels. But I presume that even alternative titles, I'm trying to think what the best one is now, but something like Honor Majesty's Secret Closet or something like that. So we don't want to do a coming out story. So that one's definitely out. But
I did have in my head when a couple of years ago, I had a idea for a script for if we ever did do a sequel. So obviously when we tried to get Jason Mendes treated, everyone was asking, are you gonna do another one? Because they were, you know, considering sort of franchising rights and stuff like that. And I at the time I sort of said definitely not. I mean it might be fun to revisit it if someone pays me to do it. I'm definitely not gonna spend my own money doing another Jason Bend, but I did have a title in mind if I did do it. But which would be Jason Bend Don't Ask, Don't Kill. I thought that would be sort of like a good kind of you know, there's so many, we had so much fun just thinking of potential titles and also potential sort of, you know, villain double entendre names. We had a whole list of about 50 of them. We went through and just picked the best ones because there's so many silly names in it, right?
Honestly, the names are incredible. It was so hard. I have resisted the urge in the piece I wrote to give away any of the names because they're just so funny. I burst out laughing all the way through that movie whenever there was a new character. So I know there's like a gender bent money penny character who has his own name. And I always think if you're going to introduce a, you know, I know we have Q now, but if you're going to introduce a recurring gay character who Bond flirts with, it would so make sense to make it money penny. you got there back in 2013, didn't you?
Yeah, no, it was good fun. It's funny watching it obviously I haven't seen it in the cinema now for a while, but when we did the festival run, you know, it was screened at a festival, the names would always get a big gag. And I think because people know that they're coming, they're always waiting for the next name reveal. And so it just became like, that became the thing of the film. Like all the critics and stuff just like writing about it saying they just couldn't wait for the next name to come up because it was going to be a good gag kind of thing. It would be quite fun if we revisited to do more of that kind of humor because we can't take credit for that. That's like classic Bond. Like that would happen in every kind of you'd wait for that moment when you're watching the old school Bonds when it was like, you know, the female antagonist has come on screen. What you're going to say her name? It would always be something ridiculous and funny, and you'd get a gag from it. And we just thought we'll take that and run with it and do a lot of it in the movie. But in terms of other future projects, I've got a couple of things in mind for other films I'd quite like to do. I've written the first draft of a psychological thriller. I think with a lot of, I really want to explore lots of different genres when I do film. I'd love to do horror at some point, but it's such a difficult genre because it's everything's been done. And you kind of stand out, you've got to either pick something really interesting. You know, and also there's so much horror, like you were saying about low budget stuff, horror is an easy one to go for because no matter how shit it is, someone will watch it. It's the most watched genre. Yes. And it's the one that brings the most profit in because you can make it on such a low budget and it will still sell. But you end up with a massive saturation of very bad horror movies. And there's a whole sort of streaming service, I think, called Shudder that's just started. It's just the horror, you know, films on like a Netflix, but just horror. I mean, how many other you know, streaming services are just one genre. It, I mean, it's, and maybe there are other ones, but, you know, and I think I love really, really well thought out horrors that, and a lot of them just resort to jump scares, you know, to have something that really seeps into your brain and, you know, stays with you. Like, I love horror films like that. And I think if I would want to try and do something, it would have to be something like that. So it's a genre that I'd love to do at some point, but I really, it has to be the right thing. But I've got in mind a psychological thriller that, again, using sort of all the resources we've got to do on a sort of low budget, but something that we could turn out something really interesting. I wrote first draft about, you know, before we actually shot In From the Side.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of been sitting on it for a while, sort of, I think, when you sit on a story and, like, let it, you know, the main themes start to reveal themselves over time and you start to sort of, you know, discard bits that don't work. And I think I'd love to revisit it with a second draft and shoot it. But I've got lots of things I'd like to do, but that one's the one that's the most sort of fleshed out. That, you know, if I wanted to, I could go back and do a rewrite and go and shoot it, you know, in a year or two. But yeah, it's a you know, different genre again. It's a three-hander. So I'm saying it's a, you know, just three actors out in the wilderness, and it's a kind of, again, like a psychological thriller, but quite multi-layered and sort of very interesting. One you could watch multiple times and you'll get different things from it because, you know, there's lots of reveals, twists and things. So it's, again, very, very different to anything I've done before.
And would that have gay character or gay characters in it?
Would it be me if it didn't? No, I mean, it's got this one's actually interesting. It's got most of the characters are bisexual, because that's something I find quite interesting, because it's something, obviously, I'm a gay man, I'm not a bisexual person, but I find there's so much. What made the rugby film interesting is a setting where all the characters could essentially get involved with each other romantically.
Yeah.
That adds a level of potential drama that you don't get, you know, in a traditional, like, you know, straight rugby. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you have a setting where most of the characters are bisexual, you increase that possibility for potential drama exponentially. And I find the idea of, I guess, straight men who are married or who hiding the, because I think a lot of, if you're gay, if you don't come out, you're living a pretty inauthentic life. But I know a lot of people who have had, you know, straight relationships essentially with women, but actually also like men, but you can hide in that a lot more than you can as a gay man, because you're not living inauthentically. You're just not exploring every part of yourself. That, and I find that yourself, really fascinating. Mm. So it's a story that explores that very heavily, you know, and whether you sort of slight latent feelings, but if you're bisexual, it's not, you're not lying about who you are. You're just not fully expressing it. And that's quite interesting. And I always want to break new ground with stuff I do and try and explore something that I find interesting. And so, yeah, I don't want to spoil too much. I can spoil the premise if you want, but I mean, it's up to you.
You've got me hooked already.
Okay. So it's essentially about a married couple, a man and a woman who have been having marital problems, who have been having couples therapy. They've been told to essentially go and do something outward bound, that they have to rely on each other, that will sort of reaffirm the bonds they have. So they go hiking in a sort of a nondescript kind of, well, I haven't decided which mountain range it's going to be, but out into the wilderness, away from friend signal, which is a standard trope or horror stuff where you remove the outside world from them. And they go, you know, hiking for 2 weeks, and they, you know, work together, they fix their bonds. But after 2 weeks of, you know, where they're absolutely middle of nowhere, 100 miles from anywhere else, they come across this very handsome and alluring stranger who is just out on his own hiking. And again, they sort of meet him, and they're bathing in a lake, and he gets to the far side of the lake. It's about 200 meters away, and slowly swims towards them. So it's this kind of ominous feeling, but alluring feeling. And they start chatting to him. They have dinner with him. He brings along some rabbits that he's killed and, you know, slaughtered in the wilderness. And he has a bottle of whiskey with him, which is a very strange thing to have when you're out hiking. You know, why would you carry unnecessary weight? They all get drunk, and they have this sort of this three-way, which for both of them, considering where they are in their marriage, is quite formative experience. And it's, you know, under campfires, so it's very kind of animalistic. And then they sort of go to sleep and pass out. He sleeps down to the stars. They sleep in their tent. And then she wakes up the next morning, and both of the two men have gone, completely disappeared. Oh. And she's left all on her own. And she doesn't know what's going on. You know, she's the less experienced hiker. She's the protagonist, essentially, in the story. After about a day of trying to find her own way back, and where she has no idea where these two men have gone, she runs into this stranger again and says, "Where did you go? You know, what happened?" And he said, "Well, I just left in the morning." And she said, "Where's my husband?" And he, "I don't know.
Oh my God.
I just And so then she's got to decide whether, you know, she can trust this guy who may or may not have done something to her husband, but is her only way back to civilization, who she's also had sex with. So there's this underlying tension of sex, you know, sexual threat, yeah, potential rape, but, you know, it's consensual, it's interesting, but it's dangerous. And then she has to travel 2 weeks with him back to civilization as they slowly distrust, and, you know, and he doesn't trust her, she doesn't trust him. And then more and more secrets get revealed about who both these characters are in relation to each other and where essentially the husband has gone.
That sounds like complete nightmare fuel.
Yes, absolutely. Is.
That's the kind of thing you wake up the next morning and think, did this actually really happen? I feel really out of sorts.
Yeah. And there's lots and lots of big twists and continual twists. So it becomes a bit of a head spinner towards the end. But I've written the first draft of it, but the second draft is needs a bit of refinement, I think.
Wow.
And then it's, but I, as I said, my parents live in the French Alps. So, and I've location scouted all the places we need for it. And I put some videos online where I put to that. So it's, again, it's a ready to go kind of project. So yes, I have been, the long story short, yeah, I've got some future projects in mind after this one. But
You that sort of person, you're working on something, but your mind kind of ends up, even though you're working full on, you still stray to something else?
Yeah, it's hard to switch it off. Like, it's hard to kind of, like, it's when I'm writing the music for the movie, it's hard to, like, you know, find a little theme that's completely not relevant to what you're doing, and then you chase that idea down and develop it. But also, I get ideas that just come to my head randomly, and I just always write them down. And I think time is a good filter for good ideas, because ideas that kind of stay in your mind and you kind of that burrow further deep, you think, actually, this needs to be explored a bit more, and you come back to it. Yeah, you sort of, over time, you can kind of figure out the ideas that need a bit more, you know, a bit more exploration on, and that you kind of want to look at and maybe do as a project. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I'm not going to take up any more of your time, Matt, because you're clearly a very, very, very busy person. But any idea of when, I know we might be tempting fate here, but have you got any, especially with the world the way it is at the moment, and movie distribution being even more of a minefield than it usually is, any idea of when we might actually be able to watch In From the Side?
This is the question I've had more than any other in the last 3 years. But I absolutely know all the time. No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm used to it. So, I mean, in theory, we're literally only a few weeks away before we get the movie done. I mean, I've been saying this for about a year, probably. So, but I think we're really, I'm really, really, like, it's as close as it's ever been before to be being finished. But in terms of who picks it up, distribution, that's the big question. Like, it's not something I essentially can comment on. Because, you know, someone, we can show it to the first distributor and they go, we love it, here's money, a bag of money, let's go distribute it. Or we might have to ship it around a bit more, or that, you know, we could sell it to someone who says, we want to sit on this for a year and release it on this date. So when it's available to see is a question I'm impossible to answer, but it should be finished very, very shortly. I hope that answers it.
And in the meantime, I know I'm following it on Instagram, and I have been since I watched Jason Bend, actually. But is it on Instagram? Is it just In From the Side? Is that correct?
It's just, yeah, In From the Side, in one long word, on Instagram. That's it. That's where we post a lot of the updates.
Yeah. And is that the best place to kind of find out any news about the film?
Yeah, I've started using Instagram a lot more for, you know, posting interesting stories, little moments of things that as the production is going along. But that's probably the best place to look at. And also you can see lots of imagery of the film as we, you know, release stuff. So yeah, that's probably the best place.
Lovely. That's perfect. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Matt. You've given me a lot of pleasure with Jason Bend. I'm really looking forward to your new film. And as I say, your ears may be burning within the Bond community for a few weeks or months to come as more people discover this movie. Thank you. Nice. You take care.
Cool. Thank you very much. Catch you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.